the men in dark suits who visited Peter visited me also. And I must admit that I take up this mantle here, both at the LBI, but also in terms of the international role that the study of German Jewry, its past, its present, and its role as a model for the future, has with a certain amount of anxiety. I'm going to be speaking about cosmopolitanism. And I want to say that this comes out of a project which Kathy Gelbin, who's the co-editor of the LBI yearbook, and I have just begun. And I want to begin by, in a sense, looking out of the window. In 1907, George Bernard Shaw, talking about or allowing Broadbent, the ultimate Englishman in John Bull's Other Island, the sort of forerunner of UKIP, to talk about what is really wrong here in London. You're thinking of the modern hybrids that now monopolize England. Hypocrites, humbugs, Germans, Jews, Yankees, foreigners, Park Laners, cosmopolitan riffraff. Don't call them English. They don't belong to the dear old island, but to their confounded new empire, and by George, they're worthy of it. And I wish them joy of it. In 100 years, between Shaw and ourselves, being cosmopolitan has gone from being riffraff to being part of the new global elite. Today, the universal claim of cosmopolitanism, of globalization and its surrogate, cosmopolitanism, is that all human beings share certain human rights, including free movement of peoples across what are seen as superficial boundaries of nation, class, race, and caste. Cosmopolitanism is a new buzzword. And it is now, in a sense, part of our new globalized vocabulary. My old friend Kwame Appiah, professor of philosophy at Princeton, in a new book called Cosmopolitanism, notes that the idea behind the Golden Rule is that we should take other people's interests seriously, take them into account. It suggests that we learn about other people's situations and then use our imaginations to walk a while in their moccasins. These are the aims we, cosmopolitans, endorse. It's just that we can't claim that the way is easy. Now, I want to make a claim this evening that the discussion of cosmopolitanism is a complicated one, and one which is integral into any understanding of the history of the Jews of Germany, the legacy of the history of the Jews of Germany, and more importantly, the self-image of the Jews of Germany. As with almost all of these studies, Appiah has a reference to the Jews. And it is, of course, a reference to the Jewish cosmopolitan without money. He speaks of the Jews in medieval Spain under the Moors and later in the Ottoman Near East, where Jews and Christians of various denominations lived under Muslim rule. This modus vivendi was possible only because the various communities did not have to agree on a set of universal values. In 17th century Holland, starting roughly at the time of Rembrandt, the Sephardic community began to be increasingly well integrated in Dutch society, and there was a great deal of intellectual as well as social exchange between Christian and Jewish communities. Christian toleration of Jews did not depend on fundamental values. Now, I'll note that, of course, these are two fantasies. Jews in a Muslim Spain, if we want to use Maimonides as an example, and if we want to talk about Jews in Amsterdam, maybe Spinoza as an example, was not uncontested. It was a 19th century fantasy of the Jews. But what's really interesting is that this fantasy is a fantasy of the Jews without money. And it replaces a mid-20th century fantasy of Jewish financial cosmopolitanism. And who else can one quote in this but Alfred Rosenberg? And quoting Rosenberg about the ultimate Jewish Bolshevik, Karl Marx, who recognized that the age of technology had descended upon the world and that this required an attendant maturation of the social framework. He, along with his followers, an international swarm of Jewish orators and literati from the cosmopolitan centers of increasingly racially degenerate cities, got together to formulate a set of social tenets for the despairing victims of an age who are so estranged from land and landscape as have to been stripped of the standards for judging these disastrous doctrine of doom. Rosenberg didn't like the Jews. Now, let me make an argument today that the tension, the real tension that exists in our contemporary notion of an elite global cosmopolitan is, in point of fact, one which is, has as its litmus test, has its way of testing the world of the cosmopolitan, the Jews. Now, I don't have to tell you when I use the phrase the Jews, I'm talking about a stereotype, a fantasy. Rosenberg's fantasy, Appiah's fantasy. And I'm going to be using that term, the Jews, all the way through this talk, even when individuals who self-label themselves as Jews are talking about Jews. Understand these are fantasies, but they're heavily invested fantasies. Now, where does this notion of cosmopolitanism come from, and especially cosmopolitanism and capital? It comes, of course, from the nomad. Now, the nomad is, think of a group of Russian Marushka dolls. The nomad hides within the cosmopolitan, and hides within the cosmopolitan in ways which absolutely mirror and form the notion of the cosmopolitan. Again, the negative nomad, Goebbels, 1935. By the way, an interesting talk, published first, not in German, but in English for the international press. Bolshevism is not merely anti-bourgeois, it is against human civilization itself. In its final consequences, it signifies the destruction of all the commercial, social, political, and cultural achievements of Western Europe in favor of a deracinated and nomadic international cabal that has found its representation in Judaism. He doesn't like the Jews either. But what we have to understand is that this notion of the nomadic becomes part and parcel of a self-reevaluation of what it means to be Jewish. One can quote Adorno in Minima Moralia, 1951, that dwelling in the proper sense is now impossible. The traditional residences we grew up in have grown intolerable. The house is past. It is part of morality not to be home in one's home. Now, such a sense of the modern nomad, and that's exactly what Adorno is talking about, turns with great irony all cosmopolitans after World War II into Jews, just as all nomads become Jews and all cosmopolitans become Jews under the Nazis. German language writers such as Alfred Anders in his 1957 novel, Zanzibar or The Last Reason, and Max Frisch in his 1961 drama, Andorra, turned the actual experience of Jews during the Holocaust into the symbolic representation of a cosmopolitan sacrificial victim. Now, let me point out that nomadism, like cosmopolitanism, has been resuscitated. It's not that it just disappears, it becomes part also of modern theory. Deleuze and Guattari in A Thousand Plateaus in 1980 rescues nomadism. Not quite cosmopolitanism, but almost. Their nomad, which they never define, which is of course typical of Deleuze and Guattari, is the liminal and anxiety-provoking, the unsettled in a world of supposed settlement. It's Adorno, in other words. But it's a state of ethical being rather than being a being, unless that being is the oft-cited Prague Jewish writer Franz Kafka. In such a world of flux, and I quote now Deleuze and Guattari, you have to listen, Jews, gypsies, etc. may constitute minorities under certain conditions, but that in itself does not make them becomings. Even the Jews must become Jewish. It certainly takes more than a state. If this is the case, then becoming Jewish affects the non-Jew as much as the Jew. A becoming minoritarian exists only by virtue of a deterritorialized medium and subject that are like its elements. Those are the new nomads. And this is the revitalization of the idea of the nomad now as the cosmopolitan. Where does this start? And it starts, as with almost all of these discussions about the universal and the Jew in the German Enlightenment. It starts with Herder. And the ideas for a philosophy of the history of mankind sees the Jews among the many little wandering hordes, as he describes them in the Old Testament. And they are the groups that create capital. Herder lists all of the innovations of these nomads, among them the invention of trade by weight and measure, the invention of capitalism. But at the same moment, or at least parallel to this, there is a discussion about other nomads. Let us say the gypsies. And I'm going to use that term because it's the term of art in the 18th century, the Sinti and Roma. And the argument that all nomads are Jews, Jews are gypsies, or perhaps gypsies are Jews. Wagenseil claims in 1705 that the first gypsies, Zigeuner, were indeed Jews who fled into the forests after having been accused in the 14th century of well poisoning, claiming that they had come from Egypt, a clear lie according to Wagenseil. There they cheated the peasants by claiming to do wondrous cures and prevent fires. Eventually they returned to the cities and again became sedentary and declared they were Jews. But thieves and beggars had joined them and they continued their nomadic ways. For proof, he claims that the gypsies were unknown before the 14th century, and that the language of today's gypsies is full of Hebrew words, and that their amulets use Kabbalistic formulas. Jews are gypsies, gypsies are Jews. All of it centers around notions of capital. And so it's no surprise that Marx, in Kapital, argues, as Herder had argued, that nomad races are the first to develop the money form, because all their worldly goods consist of movable objects and are therefore directly alienable, and because their mode of life, by continuing bringing them into contact with foreign communities, solicits the exchange of products. Right? Jews are capitals because they are nomads. All nomads are, in point of fact, capitalists. There is a mirror image of this. Leopinska argues that the statelessness of the Jew, 1882, in the age of new nationalism, damns him as a nomad. For the Jews produce, in accordance with its nature, vagrant nomads. So long as it cannot give a satisfactory account of whence it comes and whence it goes, so long as the Jews themselves prefer not to speak in Aryan society of their Semitic descent and prefer not to be reminded of it, they are nomads living as Jew peddlers. The minute the Jews say, we are Jews and we are nomads, they are no longer going to be nomads. It's exactly the opposite, but it's also an answer to the notion of nomads and capital. Always with cosmopolitanism, always with nomadism, if you want to loose the curse from the Jews, you've got to remove capital from them. Zimmel, in 1907, The Philosophy of Money, in an answer to Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, who argues, of course, that it's the Protestants who create capital, right? Argues that as a role, as a rule rather, nomadic peoples hold land as common property of the tribe and assign it only for the use of individual families, but livestock is always the private property of these families. As far as we know, the nomadic tribes has never been communistic with regard to cattle as property. Capitalism is, in point of fact, nomadic, and in back of this notion of the nomad is, in point of fact, the Jew. Now, you're going to say, well, but that's, Simmel never says that. But Zobar does, of course. The Jews of modern capitalism in 1911, he writes of the restless, wandering Bedouins, who were the Hebrews, who established this promised land and economic organization, where the powerful and mighty among them, having conquered large tracts of land, instituted a sort of feudal society. Part of the produce of the land they took for themselves, either by rent in kind, by farming it out to tax collectors, or by the means of the credit nexus. And you remember, of course, the debate among the early National Socialism about getting rid of credit and capital, because in point of fact, it was an invention of the Jews. Now Weber gets involved in this. Weber is smarter than almost everybody, no, than everybody else involved in this debate. And in ancient Judaism, he argues against exactly the Zombartian, and I would even argue the Zimmerian view of the nomad as capital. He accepts the argument, and Weber's very clever, very Nietzschean in this sense, that there is a narrative, not a historical succession, of the stages of the three patriarchs, from the nomad Abraham to the peasant Jacob. It's not history, he says, it's archetypes. And he refutes in ancient Judaism the claim, the idea that the nature of Jewish usury stems from any biblical claims to divine appropriation in Deuteronomy. He goes on, and this is really an important moment, in which he says the medieval and modern money and pawn usury of the Jews, the caricature in which this promise was fulfilled, the promise of Deuteronomy, was certainly not intended by holy promise. Rather, Weber reads the symbolic as the triumph of the city over countryside, which prevailed in every typical polis through early antiquity, from Sumerian Akkadian times. If equality of the Jews, Weber argues, it is one no different from the cosmopolitan world of the ancient city with its myth of agrarian settlement. In other words, what Weber says is, look, all of this stuff about nomadism is all made up. It's part of a historical fantasy embedded in the Old Testament. But this notion of the nomad becomes a powerful argument among the anti-Semites of the late 19th century. It becomes also a powerful argument among Jews. Adolf Valmont argues that the Jews are particularly nasty nomads. Thus, we have the typical image of the private enterprise of the nomad that continues until today in the form of wandering merchants and dealers who cross the land selling junk, stocks. This notion of a wandering stock merchant I find fascinating. I presume he means cattle, by the way, and not investment stocks. And thus rob our peasants and return on the Sabbath with their plunder home to wife and children. The nomad becomes the way that the Jew is imagined. Now, that's a very powerful notion then. The Jew is inherently nomadic. Even the highest law regarding the safety of the stranger, Zania, right, Gastfreundschaft, is not recognized by these Jewish nomads. This Jewess Yael murders Sisera after having been tempted into a tent and served milk. Trusting her, he goes to sleep. Then Yael drives a stake into his temple and mocks his mother when she comes to seek her son. Particularly nasty nomads. Now, this becomes a kind of red thread. Houston Stuart Chamberlain, 1912. Of all the histories of the ancient world, there is none that is more convincing, none more easily to be realized than the wanderings of the patriarch Abraham. It is a story of 4,000 years ago. It is a story of yesterday. It is a story of today, the Jew as nomad. It is this history of a degenerate, inflexible people, for any change in the manner of living is said to have a very bad effect on the high qualities of the genuine and purely Semitic nomads. If the Bedouin of the desert chooses a settled life, he, as a rule, unites in himself all the vices of the nomad and of the peasant. Lazy, deceitful, cruel, greedy, cowardly, he is rightly regarded by all nations as the scum of mankind. He didn't like the Jews either. Spengler. Now, this is now getting to be not only just a topos, but it becomes a way of imagining an encapsulated history of the Jew, now as cosmopolitan, but as nomad. Germany, according to Spengler, 1918, was in the grasp of inorganic cosmopolitan masses, which had to give way to a new agricultural intuitive spring, ruled by an organic structure of political existence. Such views then turn into historical theory. For Spengler, what Spengler believes that the Volk and such races never wander. The Germans never wander. They're fixed in time and space. The Jews, for Spengler, represent money, symbolically, and can only be overcome by blood, the inherited inherent ruthlessness of the folk. We have to come, of course, to Hitler. For Hitler, the Jew, of course, is a failed nomad. The Jew never possessed a state with definite territorial limits and therefore never called a culture his own. The conception arose that this was a people that should be reckoned among the ranks of the nomads. This is a fallacy as great as it is dangerous. The nomad does possess a definitely limited living space, only he does not cultivate it like a sedentary peasant, but lives from the yield of his herds with which he wanders about in his territory. I think I made the point, which is that nomadism is that doll within cosmopolitanism. And Max Brod, in 1916, in an essay on the Eastern Jewish schools, states quite boldly, "One should not inject us with being a centrifugal force in society and then marvel at the findings of nomadism and critical destruction in our corpse." What is important to understand, and I really mean it is really central to understand, is that this debate around the cosmopolitan becomes also a debate about the inner nature of the Jew. Is the Jew a world citizen, or is the Jew merely a nomad disguised as a Weltbürger? And we again return to Herder. The Jews of Moses are properly of Palestine. Outside of Palestine, there can be no Jew. Yet, he writes, a time will come when no person in Europe will inquire whether a man be a Jew or a Christian. Jews will live according to European laws and contribute to the state. For Herder, as you know, the nation in question is not racial, but linguistic and culture. But in the back of Herder's mind is the question of whether the Jews are a nation or merely wandering cosmopolitans, wandering nomads. Had the Jews stayed in the land of their fathers and in the midst of other nations, remain as they were, even when mixed with other people, they may be distinguished for the seven generations downward. But the more secluded they live, Herder writes, nay, frequently the more they were oppressed, the more their character was confirmed. Now, Herder is a great believer in cosmopolitanism. He notes that every people on earth has migrated at least once, sooner or later, to a greater distance or less. But he's quite comfortable citing Kant. And here's where this problem of capital becomes really interesting. The Jews are not cosmopolitan, they're nomadic. For every coward is a liar, Jews, for example, not only in business, but also in common life. Once you introduce capital in any discussion of the Jews, this discussion is poisoned. And it's certainly the case with Kant. As many of you know, in the contemporary discussions of cosmopolitanism, there is no one more frequently cited than Immanuel Kant. And it's very specifically, of course, two essays, The Idea for Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Purpose and Perpetual Peace, that get cited over and over again. Kant dismisses Herder. He says Herder's romantic speculations on the nature of man, in point of fact, are not grounded. He says that Kant says that the use of the right to the earth's surface, which belongs to the human race in common, would finally bring the human race ever closer to a cosmopolitan constitution. And as you know, the Prussian state was not happy with this and threatened Kant quite clearly that had he continued with this transnational cosmopolitan notion, he would have more difficulties, perhaps those men in black raincoats. Kant notes that we are bound by the historical record for the nature of the state, by our sources. And this is what interests me. That is, every time this question of cosmopolitanism gets raised, there's always a footnote to the Jews. Literally, right, in the essay on cosmopolitanism, there is literally a footnote to the Jews, because he's interested in what sources do we have for the nature of this national state. And he says, our sources, for outside of it, everything else is terra incognita. And the history of peoples outside it can only be begun when they come in contact with it. This happened with the Jews in the time of the Ptolemies through the translation of the Bible into Greek, without which we would have given little credence to their isolated narratives. Tanakh only becomes part of the historical record when, in point of fact, it comes into contact with settled, non-nomadic civilization, the Greeks. By the way, both of those statements, of course, are wrong. Kant, Pauline Kleingeld argues in a recent book, notes that cosmopolitan egalitarianism trumps cultural pluralism. He's quite happy to think about all people being equal as long as all people look like him, the inheritance of this Greco-Roman tradition. And as you know, he writes of Judaism as properly speaking not a religion at all. It is, in point of fact, again, as he writes in a long footnote, merely the belief of nomadic peoples in capital. The Palestinians, he writes in The Anthropology, living among us have, for the most part, earned a not unfounded reputation for being cheaters because of their spirit of usury since their exile. Certainly it seems strange to conceive of a nation of cheaters, but it is just as odd to think of a nation of merchants, the great majority of whom, bound by an ancient superstition that is recognized by the state they live in, seek no civil dignity and try to make up for this loss by the advantage of duping the people among whom they find refuge, and even one another. I shall not engage in the futile understanding of lecturing to these people, as Herder does, he implies, in terms of morality, about cheating and honesty. Instead, I shall present my conjectures about the origin of this particular constitution, the constitution, namely, of a nation of merchants. Now, Kant is talking here, by the way, interestingly enough, about the Ostjuden, about the Polish Jews. But you see what the difference is. When you talk about the Jews as a potential part of the cosmopolitan, about the universal, that's fine. no discussion at all of capital. But once you start to think about the Jews now as a specific group, it's defined, this group is defined over and over again by the notion of capital. Gratenauer, in 1803, writes this very famous screed against the Jews, answering in part Dohm's 1781 on the civil improvement of the Jews. And what's really important is the pseudonym he chooses for it is, can we say, a Kantian pseudonym. The book is published, written by the voice of a cosmopolitan. And as you know, those of you who have had the stomach to read Gratenauer, that he is the true cosmopolitan, not those Jewish mendicants and merchants such as Moses Mendelssohn, whom he uses as the horrible example, who extort their claims of their rights of citizenship to inflict damaging interest on innocent Christians. They are not cosmopolitan. They are, according to Gratenauer, in the end, merely nomadic Jews using this claim for their own pernicious goals. And one more witness to this interesting problem. Goethe, the great cosmopolitan, the great advocate of the Weltbürger. Kanzler von Müller comes to him and on the 23rd of September 1823 and reports that Goethe became violently enraged, prophesying the worst and most dreadful consequences, particularly undermining of all moral feelings of families that rest in religious feelings, and his desires to prevent through such marriages a Jewess from becoming Oberhofmeisterin in his court. The Weimar law had been changed so the Jews and non-Jews could marry. That's horrible. That's a terrible thing to say. But listen to this argument. Goethe says that those abroad must believe in bribery in order to understand the passage of this law. Who knows whether the all-powerful Rothschild is responsible for it? In the end, all corruption flows from the cities, from Frankfurt, from Milan, from Paris, and has its roots in capital. It's Jewish nomadism that is undermining now the German. Marx, as you know, in On the Jewish Question, not long after Goethe, argues that the Jews must see the nation as something alien to him by counterposing his imaginary nationality to the real nationality. The chimerical nationality of the Jew is the nationality of the merchant, of the man of money in general. His cosmopolitanism, of course, is a false cosmopolitanism. But the Jews make the claim of being cosmopolitan over and over and over. The Enlightenment permits them to think of themselves not as nomads, but as cosmopolitans. So when Wilhelm Rabe in 1864, in The Hunger Pastor, certainly his best known novel, most widely read novel, points out that being German is a garment easily discarded, the Jew says, I have the right to be a German when I so desire it, and the right to give up this honor at any given moment. We Jews are indeed the true cosmopolitans, Weltbürger, by the grace of God, or if you will, by God's ungraciousness. Cosmopolitanism then is a very conflicted sphere when the Jew is evoked. Is it a good thing? Well, Karl Köhler, rabbi in New York, writes that the Jew is a true cosmopolitan, but only disgusting and uncomfortable to those authorities who wish to rule and dominate with blood and iron, who destroy freedom, support bigotry, hypocrisy, and wish to corrupt eternal human rights. It's Bismarck he's talking about. All right? In other words, by the end of the 19th century, Jewish intellectuals can evoke being the true cosmopolitans, as opposed to these terrible nationalists. These terrible nationalists who play the anti-religious card. Not anti-Jewish, of course, but anti-Catholic. And the Jews argue that this is part of this biological nature of the Jew. The Jew is biologically cosmopolitan. The Jewish race alone has the capacity to dwell in every portion of the earth. Right? This is the nomad turn on its head. To reproduce and to develop without abandoning its racial specificity, Stammeseigentümlichkeiten, but also in healthier circumstances than the indigenous population. One can see in this the promise of God that Israel will spread to the limits of the world, and, by the way, the fact that Moses was the first hygienist. This is the European colonial argument turned on its head. Right? Remember Conrad, what happens, right, to Belgians when they go to Africa? They collapse. What happens when Jews go to Africa? They not only survive, they flourish because of their biological uniqueness as cosmopolitans. Now, Herzl, in a complicated way, wants to have it both ways. And here, I'm, in a sense, ventriloquizing Michael Stanislavski. Jews are both universal cosmopolitans, according to Herder, as well as essentially Jewish, but because being Jewish as a national identity was de facto claiming universal values. Right? So the more nationalist you are as a Jew, the more universal and cosmopolitan you are, because being Jewish is being cosmopolitan. Which, given the fact that Herzl believes in an organic biological definition of the Jews, he's a very much a Darwinian, is not terribly far from the quote I gave you a moment ago. He writes, Herzl writes, that it might further be said that we ought not to create new distinctions between people, he says. We ought not to raise fresh barriers. We should rather make the old disappear. But men who think in this way are amiable visionaries, unlike Herzl, right? And the idea of a native land will still flourish when the dust of their bones will have vanished tracelessly in the wind. Universal brotherhood is not even a beautiful dream. Antagonism is essential to man's greatest efforts. That is pure Darwin. That's pure Spencer, but who's going to quibble? Now, the irony, and I love irony, is that the status of the cosmopolitan and his views in the 18th century, Fichte completely agrees with Herzl. He writes that every cosmopolitan is necessarily, given his limitations by the nation, a patriot, and each who in his nation is the strongest and most active patriot is therefore the most active cosmopolitan. That's pure Herzl in the mouth of Fichte. That's pure Fichte in the mouth of Herzl. The early Zionists don't have an ambiguity about whether cosmopolitanism is a good thing. Franz Oppenheimer, much like Herzl, condemns it. Zionists are accused of being reactionary because we do not wish to proceed to an ideal that lays before us, but rather that we recede to an ideal in the past, that of the national state. The future does not lie in the emphasis on nationalism, he's creating the straw man, but in that which divides peoples rather than on that which connects them. Is the high ideal of a Weltbürgertum un-Zionist or indeed anti-Zionist? Today there spreads across the land a new culture that wishes to eradicate the difference between peoples. Today, Oppenheimer says of the Zionists, the German Zionists at least, we are the new Maccabees struggling against this utopian cosmopolitanism. Cosmopolitanism and nomadism take on quite different meanings when the index is the Jews, as symbolically defined by capital. You note that every time there is a defense of cosmopolitanism on the part of the Jews, the whole notion of capital vanishes. And when it is evoked to think about the Jews, the nomad creeps in. Now, such a history of the cosmopolitan points toward the ambivalence of these very concepts, the cosmopolitan, the nomad, when applied in our day to specific categories, whether the Jew, the asylum seeker, the migrant, the illegal, and the undocumented. These labels come to be internalized by members of these groups. This seems to be especially complex in the case of cultural producers who understand themselves as Jewish from the German Enlightenment states that will in the 19th century become Germany, as well as those of the Imperial State and Republic that has its capital in Vienna. But this is also true of the diasporic situations of these people, whether in British, American, or Palestinian exile under and following Nazi domination of these Nazi states. This remains true in contemporary Israel, formed out of the ideological debates around Zionism as anti-cosmopolitanism, and debates around diasporic nomadism, with its, when its cultural producers deal with Jews from lands other than Europe, as well as migrants today, legal and illegal, whose identity comes to be Israeli, or indeed cosmopolitan, not just Jewish. This project at looking at cosmopolitanism is a way of, in a sense, interrogating some of the underlying ideological presuppositions of whether or not a concept such as human rights, which many people in this room would espouse as a truism, is in point of fact as constructed, as complicated, and as contradictory as the relationship between the Zmarushka dolls, cosmopolitanism, and nomadism. Its history among German Jews is in a sense particularly interesting because there, in ways that are yet to be completely worked out, the poles of the cosmopolitan, the use of the nomad, come to be indexes of German Jewish identity without hyphens. This is the project that Kathy and I are beginning to work on, and we'll report back periodically how we're coming along. I thank you for your attention.